Okay, so we've been in the book of Galatians, and let's see, last week we looked at the first 10 verses of Galatians chapter number 2. So, Galatians. And so this week we're going to be looking at possibly the rest of the book of Galatians, or not the book of Galatians, the rest of the chapter number 2 here. And so last week we saw Paul continue to make his case for the gospel. And as hopefully you remember, the Judaizers had came in behind him, undermining what he had taught the church and all of the churches that he planted there through the regions of Galatia. And they were trying to discredit Paul. And they wanted to bring into question the message that he was preaching. They wanted to bring into question his apostleship. They said, well, he's not really an apostle. That Peter was an apostle, that the 11 that Jesus had chosen, they were apostles. But Paul, he didn't follow Christ while he was in his earthly ministry. And he wasn't one of the original 12. He wasn't one of these of special position. He was kind of Johnny-come-lately. And so they were questioning his apostleship. They were questioning his authority. And they were telling the Christians throughout Galatia that Paul wasn't telling them the full gospel, that they weren't getting the full story of it. And so in the first part of chapter number 2, Paul recounted his visit to Jerusalem, where he had told them all about what he had done and taught amongst the Gentiles whenever he came up to Jerusalem. And as he told his message to the apostles, the ones that the Judaizers were referring as the real apostles, as he was telling his message that he had been preaching all throughout the Gentiles, they had nothing to add to it. They had no problems with his message. They didn't want any changes. In fact, Paul had taken Titus, the Gentile, up there with him to Jerusalem and brought him in amongst all of them. And they didn't make any of these demands of Titus either. They didn't say, okay, Titus, if you're going to be a Christian, now that you're up here in Jerusalem, well, you need to go to the temple. You need to go and be circumcised. You need to keep all the laws and the commandments and all of these things. You need to go up and offer sacrifices at the altar of the temple. You've got to do all these things. They didn't do any of that with Titus. They accepted him just as he was with the gospel that Paul had preached. And so we left off last week with Paul's departure to the Gentiles in verse number 10. They had given him only one commandment and said, okay, Paul, everything that you're doing sounds great. Just make sure that you remember the poor. And he says, I was already doing that to begin with. He already had a burden for the poor and those who are in need. He was already showing the love of Christ in the things that he was doing. And so that was one of the commands that they had given him was, okay, as you're going about and preaching the gospel, make sure that you're basically living it as well, that you are showing the love of Christ wherever you go, more than just the message, but also living it. And that's what we see in verse number 10. Remember the poor, he says, the same which I was forward to do means I already was doing that. And so as he departed, I assume that since it seems like he had a pretty good visit with all of the guys up there, fellow Christians, and as he had that good visit with them, I could imagine him as he was leaving telling them, why don't you come down and see for yourself what I'm doing? Because that's kind of what was called into question, that Paul, what his message was, the Jews weren't real keen on Paul because he was going to the Gentiles to begin with, and they were very prejudiced toward the Gentiles. And now you'll find all kinds of religious groups today who have all kinds of prejudices, and this group doesn't like that group, and different things. You don't find that in scriptures. It's not that way. The only places you find that is whenever it's being rebuked, because you find that the Jews were very prejudiced against the Gentiles, and God, in his sense of humor, makes it very apparent that he's very accepting of the Gentiles, and that they're that the Jews have nothing on the Gentiles, basically. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, like I said, I assume that there was an open invitation to come and observe it. Said, okay, if you've got more questions, I've told you what I've preached and taught amongst the Gentiles, but why don't you come down and see what God's doing for yourself? Because whenever Jesus left, he told the disciples, told the apostles there, go into all the world and preach the gospel, right? And they were predominantly concentrated in Jerusalem. He said, go to the entire world, preach the gospel. And they said, well, we're kind of comfortable right here where we're at. And so Paul comes to town and they start questioning him. And he has to come to them instead of them going to him, right? And so I can imagine Paul saying, hey, if you're wondering what's going on amongst the Gentiles, you know, Jesus did tell you to go into all the world. Why don't you come down and see what's going on? Why don't you come down and have a part of it? And the reason I say that I believe there was an open invitation there is in the verse that we start out with in verse number 11 here, Peter comes to check out things. And so that's where we're going to be looking today is Peter's visit to Antioch. And it seems that after this meeting, Peter decided to check things out for himself. Or he may have been sent by James and John and the rest of the apostles or the church there at Jerusalem. I don't know. It doesn't say for sure. I can figure that Peter was probably more open to visit the Gentiles than what any of the rest of them was, for the simple fact that, remember, he in the book of Acts, he receives the vision of the sheep being let down and all of the creeping animals and all this stuff on the sheep that's let down, and God telling him, arise, Peter, kill and eat. And he says, not so, Lord, I won't eat anything that's common or unclean. And God says, don't call what I've cleansed common or unclean. He does that three times, and immediately there's somebody knocking at the door asking for him. They're Gentiles saying, hey, Peter, come and preach to us Gentiles. And God's already given him this vision and showed him, hey, come down to the Gentiles. It's okay that I've got a plan for them. Right. And so Peter went down to Cornelius, and the people there that were Gentiles preached the gospel, saw them get saved, saw them trust Christ, and they received the Holy Spirit. And it was very apparent that God was accepting of Gentiles. Right. So of all the people there, Peter would be the one who would have been most accepting of this, or most ready to go down and see what Paul was doing. And so anyway, he goes down and to Cornelius and all of that, and that kind of prepared him. And so now he's going down to Antioch, into Gentile territory again. And now, just as a side note here, if this seems odd, I know we often, as we're studying the Bible, we have this distinction between Jews and Gentiles. Obviously, we're Gentiles, right?
Right.
And there's the distinction there between Jews and Gentiles, but all it was is the Jews were the ones who were the people of Israel. That was it. The Gentiles was anyone who was not an Israelite.
Right.
And like I said, it originally played out that God chose Abraham, chose the people of Israel, not because he loved them more, not because they were special, not because of anything that they had ever done, but God chose Abraham to reveal himself to them because at that point in time, basically almost all of the world had turned away from God, the God that had created them. And so with that, God was reintroducing himself to his creation. I mean, that's kind of an odd thing for us to think of, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, how far are we from that today?
Yeah.
You know, isn't it similar?
Yeah. And so what had happened is that from Adam knew God personally. Up to the time of Noah was the only one who was worshiping God, him and his family. They were the only ones left, and God wiped out everyone besides Noah and started over with Noah. And from Noah to Abraham, the world had basically forgotten about God. Even Abraham himself, I mean, it went a step further than Noah, because Abraham himself was not worshiping God whenever God revealed himself to him. It reveals to us in the scriptures that Abraham's family were idol worshipers. They were pagans. And Abraham would have been brought up in that. And so God just appears to Abraham one day and says, hey, I'm the true God. I'm the one that created all of this. You know, all of you down here on the earth kind of forgotten about me, but I want to reintroduce myself. I'm God. Mm-hmm. Okay? And he says, if you'll trust me, if you'll follow me, I have a plan for you. And I'm going to use you and all of your family to reintroduce me to this world. Okay? And so that's what God did through Abraham. And so they took it rather than, our job is to be God's ambassadors and be, you know, his representatives to the world to reveal him to the world again. They said, God picked us and not you. We're his favorites. I mean, that's what it ended up being. And so rather than, because this is what man always does, right? You know, man's the only thing of God's creation that doesn't do what it was created to do. You ever think of that?
Man. So man would be God's greatest enemy.
No, it wouldn't be his greatest enemy, but it's the only part of his creation that doesn't do what it was designed to. You know, if you ever make anything, you know, building something, creating something, baking something, you know, we always have things that fail.
Yeah.
I mean, just like we've told the story about whenever we moved here to Ireland, we were going to make a pork roast, okay? Mm-hmm. And we ended up, we didn't know. We looked and we found a ham joint or something, mm-hmm. bacon joint. I don't know what it was called. And it looked like just a piece of pork loin. And we're like, hey, this is going to make a great roast. So before church one morning, we throw it in the crock pot and let it cook while we're at church. Come home and we're ready to have, you know, our roast pork with potatoes and carrots and all these things. I'd seasoned it and spiced it up and everything. And I slice it off and I said, well, it kind of smells funny. And I go to eat a piece of it and it is so stinking salty. It was ham. You know, it's what we would have called ham. And I thought it was just plain pork loin. It didn't look like it had been cured or salted or anything. It just looked like plain meat.
Yeah.
And so that meal was a complete bust. I mean, the meat wasn't really edible because it was so salty. And so it didn't do what I'd expected it to do. I mean, that was one of my creations that failed.
Yeah.
Okay? But looking at all of God's creation, I mean, all the animal kingdom, the plants, the way the solar system, everything works, the water cycle, I mean, everything does exactly what God planned it to do.
Yeah.
I mean, it just continues going. But God created man to have a relationship with him, and man just like, nah, I think I'll just go out and do my own thing.
Right.
And so man's really the only part of God's creation that doesn't do what it was designed to do. And so continuing with that, you know, the children of Israel, God said, okay, I'm revealing myself to Abraham, and of your children, of your seed, will the whole earth be blessed. And of course, the Messiah came through Abraham's family. He had to have a family on the earth that the Messiah would come from. It was promised since Genesis, you know, early Genesis. And so anyway, with all of that, the children of Israel were going to be the ones who the Messiah would come from, but also the ones who would know God. And God led them. I mean, he manifested himself to them in miraculous ways.
Right.
I mean, you look at him coming out of Egypt and parting the Red Sea and all these different things. But instead of saying, hey, our God is the true God and he loves us and he's a good God and he takes care of us and you really need to get to know our God. That's really what, in essence, Christians are supposed to be doing today. But that's what the Jews were supposed to be doing back then. But instead of that, they were saying, we're his favorites. He loves us. He hates you. You can go to hell and we're going to be his favorites.
Yeah.
And that was their attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, that sounds a little harsh, I know, but that's how they looked at it. And so in Jesus' day, it was still the same way that the Jews were going around and saying, we're superior. They were referring to all the Gentiles as dogs.
Mm-hmm.
We don't like to be called a dog, do we? No, that was just as derogatory back then as it is today. And so they thought of everyone outside of their nation of being completely inferior. I mean, so much so that they wouldn't eat in their homes. They wouldn't stay under their roofs. The Samaritans, for instance, they wouldn't even travel through their land. They would go around it so you didn't have to come across them. Okay, they were considered unclean. If they went and had any dealings with Gentiles, they had to come and bathe and clean their clothes and purify themselves because they felt like they had been defiled. I mean, that's pretty severe, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so they still had this prejudice, this mindset. We can look at the same thing in recent history, is that many whites were that way toward blacks. You know, looked at them as being inferior, unclean, didn't want anything to do with them. They were like animals to them. And yeah, some people still that way. And so with that, the Jews were that way toward the Gentiles. I mean, could you imagine one nation and a smaller nation? Imagine if Ireland thought it was superior to the rest of the world and they thought they had arrived and they were God's favorites and God loved them and didn't love anybody else. And they were the only ones who God was going to have anything to do with and everybody else was just on their own. I mean, that'd be kind of crazy, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But that's kind of the way that Israel was. And so anyway, whenever the Gentiles started believing on Christ and started being saved and following the God of Israel, the God of the world and the universe in reality, but whenever they started doing that, the Jews were kind of off put by it. They're like, how dare them serve our God? He's our God. You know, we kind of had a corner on him. And then whenever they weren't keeping the laws and everything else that the Jews had built up to be this great big system and ceremonial and ritualistic type thing. They had made their religion out of what God had given them. You know, and man's done that time after time after time, is taken what God had given them and perverted it and added to it and twisted it and turned it around into this big religious monstrosity. And that's what Judaism was in the days of Christ. It was a big religious monstrosity. And so whenever the Gentiles were being accepted by God without submitting to their religious monstrosity, they didn't like it. And they said, if you want to serve our God, you've got to submit to our religion that we have placed God in their way of thinking, okay?
Right.
And so it wasn't God that had designed it. It was the Jews. But you see what we're talking about when we're talking about the hatred and the animosity between the Jews and the Gentiles. It's much the same way. And so that gives us a little bit of perspective of why all of these Jewish Christians, whenever Jesus told them, go into the entire world, preach the gospel to every creature. Okay? Just the same way as all the children of Abraham, all of them were supposed to be witnesses of God into the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
Be salt and light. They were still in Jerusalem. And so, like I said, I believe that Paul gave them this challenge and said, why don't you leave Jerusalem at some point in time? Why don't you get out of Israel and see that God is bigger than Israel? See that God is bigger than your churches that are up there, that He's got something bigger and better planned than just a little isolated group within one country. But He is spreading out through the entire region and He's doing something big here. And if you leave Jerusalem once in a while, you'd figure that out.
Right.
That God's not just fitting in your box and in your pocket. They thought that they could corner God in the temple and said, okay, God, we'll place you in the temple and we will serve you in the temple, but you stay in the temple and let us live out here how we want to. Let us commercialize religion. Let us do all these things that we want to do, but you just stay in the temple and whenever it's convenient, we'll come see you. And Paul's giving them the challenge that God's not in their temple, that He can't be confined to one place, and that He can work in more places than just in Israel, and He didn't need the permission of the high priest to do so. And so as we look here in verse number 11 of chapter 2, it says, but when Peter was come to Antioch, and now Antioch is outside of Israel, it's Gentile territory, it's in Syria. But when Peter was come to Antioch, I withstood him to the face, because he was to be blamed. For before that certain came from James, he did eat with the Gentiles, but when they were come, he withdrew and separated himself, fearing them which were of the circumcision. And the other Jews dissembled likewise with him, insomuch that Barnabas also was carried away with their dissimulation. But when I saw that they walked not uprightly according to the truth of the gospel, I said unto Peter before them all, if thou, being a Jew, livest after the manner of Gentiles, and not after the Jews, why compellest thou the Gentiles to live as the Jews, who are Jews by nature, or we who are Jews by nature, and not sinners of the Gentiles, knowing that a man is not justified by the works of the law, but by the faith of Jesus Christ? Even we have believed in Christ, or in Jesus Christ, that we might be justified by the faith of Christ, and not by the works of the law. For by the works of the law shall no flesh be justified. But if, while we seek to be justified by Christ, we ourselves also are found sinners, is therefore Christ a minister of sin? God forbid. For if I build again the things which I destroyed, I make myself a transgressor. For I, through the law, am dead to the law, that I might live unto God. I am crucified with Christ, nevertheless I live, yet not I, but Christ liveth in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. I do not frustrate the grace of God, for if righteousness come by the law, then Christ is dead in vain. Let's go ahead and turn that thing off for a minute. With that thing running, I can't hear myself think. So anyway, as we look through this chapter here, a lot of great stuff here, but what you might see predominantly in this very first part that we read, Peter came to Antioch and Paul says, I withstood him to the face. You know, we picture that and we think of it being a great big fight, huh?
Yeah.
But the thing is, we've got to be careful and not read our tone into it.
Right.
We're bad about that occasionally, or I am anyway. As I'm reading over things, I read my tone into it, and oftentimes it's a very fleshly tone. You know, I look at it, and Paul stands up and confronts Peter, and, you know, he hasn't spent that much time with Peter. He doesn't really care about Peter's opinion, and he just stands up and lets him have it. But that's not what we see in this.
Right.
And one of the reasons I say that is because, for one, that would be very unchristlike. Could you imagine him rebuking Peter for being unchristlike and doing it in an unchristlike way?
Right.
I mean, that would be very hypocritical on his part.
Yeah.
You know, you don't call out someone for being a hypocrite while being a hypocrite yourself.
Exactly.
I mean, a lot of people do, but you shouldn't. And of all people, I don't believe Paul was. I believe he was doing this properly. And if he had done it in the flesh and would have done it in a hypocritical way, I don't believe he's going to be bringing it up and bragging about it to the Galatians there.
Right.
And so anyway, in telling this account here, and I'll get into it in just a minute, a little bit more explanation about what happened, but in telling this account, I don't believe he was doing it for the sake of gossip. I don't think he was doing it to run Peter down. He wasn't writing to the Galatians and saying, man, I let Peter have it. You should have saw it. Okay? But in fact, the problem he was having in the churches in Galatia was that they were lifting Peter up as if Peter was the head apostle, that he was the one that had all the power and the authority and that he could do no wrong, and that he was above Paul, and that Paul would be subservient to him. Okay? And that was the way that they were portraying it. And so if they lifted Peter up as being superior, we can see where the Judaizers were already trying to make a hierarchy. Okay? They were lifting Peter up and be as if Peter was the most important. Okay?
Yeah.
And so Paul relates this story to show equality among the apostles. Okay? And I believe this rebuke was done in a respecting manner here. It wasn't, you know, him tearing him down or putting him in his place. It was that they were on equal footing to watch out for one another's souls. Okay? It was Peter stepped out of line and Paul said, hey, wait a minute, Peter, what you're doing is not right. And this is why. And so he was giving him a correction, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And Peter was taking that correction in a godly manner and changed course in it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to see why it was so important, because honestly, what has happened here, just to summarize, to clarify it, whenever Peter came down to Antioch, Antioch was predominantly Gentile. There would have been some Jewish Christians there, but it would have been predominantly Gentile. And with them being predominantly Gentile, they didn't know, the Jewish laws, the Jewish customs, the laws, the ceremonies, the rituals, the cleansings, the clean foods, unclean foods, the Sabbaths, and all the... They didn't know all that, nor did they need to. Nor had Paul taught them that, because that was all part of the ceremonial laws, and that was gone. Jesus did away with that. It was a picture of what Jesus would one day do, but Jesus already did it, so why do they need the picture? And so anyway, whenever Peter came down here to Antioch, he would have been around the Gentiles. That would have already been a big step for a Jew. But he was with the Gentiles. He was going to church with the Gentiles. He was staying at the Gentiles' houses because he couldn't just go to the nearest B&B or the nearest hotel. I mean, whenever you traveled back then, you were relying upon other people's hospitality. And so he was spending the night in Gentiles' houses. He was eating around the table with Gentiles. He was eating Gentile foods, and more than likely, he was eating foods that were not kosher. Okay? Not acceptable to the Jews. And so as he was down there, he had already, you know, had his vision from God, and it seems like he was taking it to heart. I mean, God says, don't call what I've cleansed unclean. He said, I've cleansed it. It's okay, Peter. You can go ahead. You can let go of all these ceremonial things. I've taken care of that. And so Peter was down there, and at what Paul says there, he says, you were living like a Gentile.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So the way Jewish Peter was doing, he came down there, and he was living just as if he had been a Gentile. He was eating what Gentiles ate. He was going where Gentiles went. He was sleeping where Gentiles slept. And he was just like one of them. Now imagine these Judaizers. Okay? The ones that had went to Galatia and told all of them that Paul wasn't actually an apostle and that all of the Gentiles needed to become Jews in order to be Christians. Now Paul is telling them whenever Peter came amongst the Gentiles, Peter became a Gentile instead of the Gentiles becoming Christians. Or instead of the Gentiles, excuse me, becoming Jews.
Right.
I mean, that was quite an illustration for him, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Because the Judaizers didn't live there in most places. They came along and they said, okay, now you've got to start doing like we do whenever we come amongst you. But Paul was saying whenever Peter, you know, the Peter, came amongst the Gentiles, he lived as a Gentile.
Right.
Complete opposite. I mean, this turns this whole argument on its head. Because, as you remember, this is what they're fighting against. They're telling these poor Gentiles, they're saying, okay, you've gotten saved. Now you've got to do all of these religious ceremonies. You've got to keep all of these religious rules. It's not the moral law we're talking about. I mean, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal. That's not what we're talking about.
Right.
It is the dietary laws. It is the Sabbaths and the holy days and the feasts and the festivals and the circumcisions and all these things, the purifications and all that. And they're trying to tell the Gentiles they have to do that now in order to be a Christian. And if I was one of those Gentile Christians and I just trusted Christ as my Savior and they come and say, okay, now you've got to do all of these things. I'd say, wait a minute. That's not what I signed on for. This isn't what I was told.
Right.
And so it was messing with them. And so it was on the verge of either leading these Gentiles into a works-based salvation system and a ritualism, or pushing them away from Christianity altogether as these Judaizers were coming in.
Right.
So Paul was making it clear that this wasn't the case, this wasn't what was going on, that they were saved by grace through faith. And so anyway, as we see here, like I said, Paul was relating the story to show equality amongst even the apostles. And it would show that Peter himself was not perfect, that he didn't keep the law, and in fact, he wasn't the Pope. I mean, he wasn't the one that was at the head that everybody else had to answer to. And so in verse 11 and 12, it says, "But when Peter was come to Antioch, I withstood him to the face because he was to be blamed." In other words, he was in the wrong. "For before that certain came from James, he did eat with the Gentiles, but when they were come, he withdrew himself and separated, fearing them which were of the circumcision." So we said that he came down and he was acting like a Gentile. He was living as the Gentiles did until some of the Jews came along.
Right.
And it says some of the Jews from up in Jerusalem came down to where Peter was staying at, where Paul was at, and all of a sudden Peter started acting differently. He wouldn't go to supper with the Gentiles anymore. He wouldn't sit where they sat. He wouldn't sleep where they slept. And he was separating himself from them, acting as if they were second-class Christians.
Right.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so this is what he was doing. And Paul said that he withstood him to the face because he was to be blamed, because he did this out of fear of the circumcision. So here's another example to the Judaizers at that time, and to the Galatians and all the Gentiles, that Peter wasn't the one that was the head honcho. He wasn't the one on top. He wasn't the one that everybody else answered to. That Peter was, in fact, afraid of his peers.
Mm-hmm.
Peter gave in to peer pressure. I mean, honestly, that's what happened. The Jews came down, and we don't know why exactly they came down. It doesn't say. It could have been that they were just curious. They were doing the same thing Peter was, coming down and seeing what was going on in Antioch.
Yeah.
It could have been that word had gotten back to Jerusalem that you should see Peter down there amongst the Gentiles. You can't tell him from one of them. He's down there. He's eating pork. He's sleeping in their houses. He's not going to but he's not going down to the I keep wanting to say the temple, but the synagogue on the Sabbath day. He's not doing all of these things, and all the Jews would have been all upset about it, saying, "Peter, you know, the Peter, the apostle Peter, he's one of us. He's a Jew, and he's down there living like those dogs, those Gentiles. we better go check and see if these rumors are true. That may have been the reason why these guys came down. They may have been going down to see if the rumors were true. They might have just been going down to see for themselves. Or they may have been coming down even with a reprimand from the church that was in Jerusalem. James might have said, hey, Peter's getting out of control down there, guys. You better go rein him in. Which, that would have been wrong in itself.
What church was that at that time?
Do what?
What church was in Jerusalem at that time?
It just would have been a church, just a group of believers.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it's just the pattern you see throughout the New Testament. A group of people trust Christ, believe on him. All of them are saved, and they start meeting together, joining together. And that's what...
Specific
place. Yeah. And, well, originally they would gather together at the temple. You know, the Jews would do most of what they did on the Sabbath day, on Saturday.
Yeah.
And then on Sunday, you know, there's not a whole lot going on at the temple, and all the Christians would get together at the temple. Mm-hmm. You know, that was their meeting place. It says that they went together, or they gathered together from house to house every day of the week. Mm-hmm. And so there was so many, if you think about it, on the day of Pentecost that we looked at on Sunday, on the day of Pentecost, there was 3,000 people believed on Christ, trusted him as Savior in one day.
Right.
So 3,000 people one day in Jerusalem. Then it says there was added to the church daily. And it doesn't say how many, if it was one or 1,000. But there was people being added daily. It wasn't too much longer after that. In addition to those 3,000, there was another 5,000 that got saved. Mm-hmm. And so in Jerusalem, the church would have quickly been over 10,000 people. Mm-hmm. And so it would have been many of them would have been house churches.
Yeah.
Okay, they would have been gathering together, and that's one reason why there had to be so many of them, as far as the pastors, the leaders of the church, and why they had to meet every day is because they were going from house to house to house to house, fellowshipping, teaching, and doing all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And so, with that, I mean, they were all Christians. They were gathered together and intermixing and all, but you know the way that it goes amongst any tight-knit group, that whenever a little bit of news comes about, it spreads quickly.
Yeah.
And so I can imagine someone coming up from Antioch, coming into Jerusalem and said, hey, I was just down in Jerusalem and I saw Peter down there. Yeah, he was down there with Paul. Yeah, but you don't understand. He wasn't acting like a Jew. You know? And so it may have been any of the three. They may have just been down there out of their own curiosity, just like Peter was, seeing what was going on. They may have been down there checking to see if the rumors were true, or they may have went down there even with somewhat of a reprimand, saying, hey, Peter, you're going to have to chill out because the Jews are getting upset. They're hearing that you're down here and you're throwing all of the law and all the customs and all of your culture behind you and acting like a Gentile.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could have been either any of the three. We don't know for sure. And so anyway, as he was there fellowshipping with him equally, that didn't last long because as soon as these guys showed up, he separated from them. He separated from all the Gentiles. He started treating them, like I said, as if they were second-class Christians.
Right.
And so anyway, whatever the cause of their visit was, their presence caused Peter to change his action toward the Gentiles, and segregation began within the church at Antioch. I mean, you start seeing a church split amongst the believers that Paul was in the middle of, and this was his church family. And he starts seeing a church split, the Jews and the Gentiles. And he starts seeing the Gentiles are over here and the Jews are over here. And like I've said several times, God didn't ever intend there to be a Gentile church and a Jewish church, a white church and a black church.
Right.
I mean, he never did. It was always meant to be one. And so anyway, as the segregation began, it would send up a lot of red flags to the Gentiles. And so suddenly, they would be made to feel, like I said, that they were second-class Christians, and they would feel pressure to conform to Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
They would start looking at all of the Jews, and they're saying, they won't mingle with us, they won't eat with us, they treat us as if we're unclean. So we're going to have to become like them because apparently they're closer to God. They're preferred of God. That God likes them because they do all of these things. And it starts becoming about what they do instead of about what Christ done.
Right.
And it completely perverts the gospel.
Right.
So problems are coming up. And so like I said, it would bring this pressure upon the Gentiles. And they would start thinking the same way as what these Judaizers were teaching. That we're going to have to become as Jews in order to be accepted by them and their God. They're still holding us on the outside. We still can't become part of them. And so that would have really messed them up. And so, like I said, the message was sent that it wasn't until they became Jews that they would be, or that until they became Jews that they would be inferior or less Christian. And so Paul would have none of that. I mean, he saw this coming. Okay, he saw this coming from a mile away, if you want to say it that way. And he says, we've got to get rid of this. We've got to nip it in the bud.
Yeah.
Okay? Because it may seem like something small and insignificant. Yeah, you know, Paul, the Jews, they're over here and the Gentiles are over here. It's okay. But Paul knew the message it was sending. And knew how it was marring the gospel. It was perverting the gospel is what it was doing. Because it was putting a two-tier system amongst Christianity. It was doing that hierarchy.
Right.
It was the us versus them. It was they are superior, we are inferior.
Mm-hmm.
We're just the Gentiles down here, but they're the Jews. They're God's favorites. And so it puts that in there. And Paul knew that he had to do something. And Peter's sin was public, and it had far-reaching consequences. So Paul rebuked him publicly. I mean, that's a good rule of thumb. Because if what you do, just like I myself, okay? If I did something, if I royally messed up, if I committed a sin publicly, okay? And it was well known to the community, do I just go and apologize to one person within the community? No, I need to go and do my best to make it right with everyone who's privy to it, right?
Right.
And so this sin was public. It was something that was causing problems all throughout the church there in Antioch. And so Paul decided that he would confront him publicly about it.
Mm-hmm.
But along with confronting him publicly, he confronted him with the right heart, the right motive, the right attitudes,
mm-hmm.
which is very important.
Yeah.
And I can't say this enough times. Too often, we in our flesh, whenever we've got a beef with someone, even if we're right and they're wrong, we want to make sure that they know that they're wrong and we're right.
Yeah.
And it becomes a matter of pride. We want to make them feel about this tall and we want to stand about that tall, you know?
Mm.
And that's what we try to do. And that is not Christ-like. That's not the way that it's supposed to be.
Right.
And so I believe wholeheartedly, as Paul confronted Peter, it wasn't with fire and rage.
Right.
It was with a broken heart and deep concern.
Yeah.
And he's like, wait, Peter, you don't understand what you're doing. Let me point this out.
Yeah.
Okay? And so anyway, as he rebuked him publicly, I believe he was careful with how he handled this. Because Peter was a fellow apostle.
Mm-hmm.
Peter was one who was well respected in the church.
Right.
And you can't have Paul and Peter having sword fights in the middle of the church building. You know, that's not going to work out very well. And so anyway, as I said, we can't read a unchristlike or unloving tone into this passage. I don't believe it's there, even though I don't know how many times I've read this and I've seen it there. And I'm like, go get him, Paul. That wasn't the spirit that was behind it. For further proof on that, if you look in, you don't have to turn there, but if you look in 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15, you have Peter. You know, the book of Peter was written by Peter. And Peter refers to Paul as his beloved brother.
Mm-hmm.
If Paul just took this opportunity and just absolutely tore him up publicly, do you think that Peter is going to refer to him as his beloved brother Paul?
No.
Probably not. You know, we have, and there's many people, I've read commentaries and different things, of people who thought that there was an ongoing feud between Paul and Peter, as if they were almost rivals. Okay? That's messed up. I mean, it really is. If there's people out there, I mean, there's, you know, people who claim to be Bible scholars that believe that Peter and Paul didn't get along and that they were constantly butting heads with one another and at odds with one another.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how many times are they teaching and preaching for unity? How many times are they teaching and preaching about having Christ-like attitudes? And, Even if you look at Paul and his qualifications of a pastor, do you not think that, you know, Paul would strive to meet all those qualifications? And if he was having an ongoing feud with Peter, that wouldn't have happened. Mm-hmm. There was respect between Paul and Peter.
Yeah.
And so anyway, Paul wasn't disrespectful or condescending to Peter. We could learn a lot from that in our interactions with other people and how we handle ourselves and try to do it in a Christ-like way. And so he publicly rebuked Peter's inconsistency and the message that his actions preached. We often underestimate the message that we portray with our actions.
Mm-hmm.
We think that we have to say something in order to preach a message. But as the old saying goes, actions speak louder than words. And Peter's actions was saying a bunch. And so, as Peter put distance between him and the Gentiles, other Jewish believers did likewise. They put distance between them and the Gentiles. Even down to Barnabas. I mean, faithful Barnabas. The name Barnabas means encourager, and he was known to be an encourager. I mean, he was a great Christian. But Peter's actions even caused Barnabas to do the same here. And so it's a great warning to guard our actions due to our influence.
Right.
Our influence upon others. If we look at verse number 13, it says, "And the other Jews dissembled likewise with him, insomuch Barnabas also was carried away with their dissimulation." Now we see dissembled and dissimulation there. The word dissimulation means hypocrisy. That's what that is. And so he called Peter out basically here on being hypocritical in what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and honestly, that's the essence of hypocrisy. Peter was fine with hanging out with the Gentiles until the Jews came along, and then he wouldn't hang out with the Gentiles. He was being a hypocrite.
Yeah.
And so Paul says here that they dissembled likewise. They came out from amongst the Jews or the Gentiles. They segregated, and they did it hypocritically. And so verse number 14, "But when I saw that they walked not uprightly according to the truth of the gospel, I said unto Peter before them all, If thou being a Jew livest after the manner of Gentiles and not as do the Jews, why compellest thou the Gentiles to live as do the Jews?" And so as Paul confronted Peter for his inconsistency, the biggest issue was that his actions were contrary to the gospel. Okay? The message of the gospel is that we are accepted by Christ regardless of our works, our actions, our nationality, our position, our heritage, any of those things, that we are accepted by Christ by grace.
Right.
Unmerited. It's nothing that we deserve.
Exactly.
And so his actions are saying that we are more deserving, more loved, more accepted than the Gentiles. So you see we're twisting the gospel already.
Right.
And so anyway, as his actions stated that the Jews' works made them better and more accepted, it completely undermined the fact that they were saved and accepted by God's grace with no merit at all on their part. And it set a very dangerous precedent. His actions compelled the Gentiles to live as Jews. We looked at that a little bit earlier. So in verses 15 through 17 now, Paul continues his account of his words to Peter. This is what he's saying. He's basically, in his letter to the Galatians, he is quoting his account. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
This is what I said to Peter whenever I was there. This is the conversation that we had. So he's being transparent with it. Now, another thing that I think I said last week is that as he's putting all of this in writing, that makes it even more weighty. And the reason for that is the Galatians can take Paul's letter, take it to Peter and say, "Peter, is this the way that it really happened? We've got it in Paul's writing with Paul's signature at the end of it. Is Paul telling us the truth, Peter?" And Peter would have to say, "Yeah, I did that. I'm glad he straightened me out because I was really messing things up. It was good that Paul was there." And I figure that's what Peter would have said if they would have been confronted with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, in verse number 15 it says, "We who are Jews by nature and not sinners of the Gentiles, knowing that a man is not justified by the works of the law, but by the faith of Jesus Christ, even we have believed in Jesus Christ, that we might be justified by the faith of Christ, and not by the works of the law. For by the works of the law shall no flesh be justified. But if, while we seek to be justified by Christ, we ourselves also are found sinners, is therefore Christ the minister of sin? God forbid. For if I build again the things which I destroyed, I make myself a transgressor. So with what Paul says here, he makes one of the clearest cases you'll find anywhere in Scripture that our works, that the works of the law, whether it be the Jewish law or whatever rules and regulations religion has put upon it since then, okay, that none of that have any bearing on our salvation, that we are saved by grace through faith,
right,
not of any works that we do whatsoever. And so anyway, in verse number 15 here, it always kind of caught me a little funny in verse number 15. We who are Jews by nature are not sinners of the Gentiles. That's condescending, isn't it?
Yeah.
We're Jews. They are sinners. Okay? But that's not what he's saying. He's not placing a division between the Jews and the Gentiles, but he's simply pointing out the Jewish mindset at the time, which Peter was falling back under. He's like, hold on here a second, Peter. I need to wake you up, snap out of this. Okay? We who are Jews by nature. Okay? We who are Jews by nature. In other words, we did nothing to become a Jew. What caused a Jew to be a Jew? Oh, it was their heritage, right?
Right.
It's the same thing that makes you Irish, right, Mary?
Yeah.
It just happened that you were born here out of the same... I mean, were you planning it out before you were born and said, okay, I'm going to plan out, I'm going to be born in Ireland, I'm going to be Irish. You didn't have you weren't floating out there in space somewhere trying to figure out which continent or country or planet am I going to end up on. You know, that's not the way that it works. You don't get to decide. And so we're Jews we're Jews by nature. We're not sinners like the Gentiles. Wait a minute now. That just sounds messed up all the way around, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to figure it out, but I can't. And the more I try, the more confused I get. Jesus was a Jew, so why are we so anti-Jews today?
Well, it depends on what you're saying as far as we. I am not anti-Jew. I mean, the Bible makes it clear for a Christian, we're to love the Jews.
Yeah, you know, all of them.
But the problem is what you see here in Ireland is a hatred for the Jews.
Yeah.
For one, I'll tell you the main reason for it, okay? The main reason is the teaching of the Catholic Church that it's called replacement theology. Have you ever heard of that?
I've heard of theology, but not replacement.
Okay.
No.
Theology is very, very, very big.
Yeah.
but replacement theology is only one specific part of it. And what replacement theology is it teaches that a group has replaced Israel. Okay? And it's taught not just amongst the Catholics, it's taught amongst other groups as well. But what the teaching is that God chose Israel, put them in a special and privileged position, gave them all these covenants and promises, and then they really bombed it. They just messed up. And we talked about earlier that they did mess up. But then ultimately they killed Jesus, rejected Jesus. So God has rejected Israel now. And because God has rejected Israel, he has replaced them with another group. And the Catholic Church teaches that they have replaced Israel. Okay? And that they teach that they replaced Israel, and what that goes down into is they say that they have inherited all of the promises that God made to Israel in the Old Testament. You look at the promises that God made to Abraham, the promises that God made to Moses, the promises that God made to David, there are covenants there. Okay? There are promises. And he promised that that there would be a ruler that came out from Israel that would reign, okay?
Yeah.
And that would be king, would reign over the entire earth. And that's Christ. That'll one day happen, okay?
Yeah.
And that his throne will be set up there and all of these things. And it centers around Israel. And God's not done with Israel. He's still got plans. And you read through the book of Revelation, the prophecies in Daniel and things, there's still things in line for Israel,
right,
okay? But what those who teach replacement theology do they put themselves, whatever category they fall into, whether it be the Catholic Church or some other Christian denomination or something, they say, we are the ones that are replacing Israel. They rejected God. God has rejected them, and they're the losers in this thing. And so that's why there's a hatred and animosity toward the Jews, is because they see them as rejectors of God, and that they are rejected, cast aside by God. And so they see Israel as being under God's wrath, so they feel as if it is acceptable for Israel to be under their wrath as well. Okay? And so with that, the Catholic Church teaches that as they've replaced Israel, replaced them, that now all of the things that used to apply to Israel now applies to the Catholic Church, and that one day the Catholic Church will be the ruling group over the entire world, and that Christ will one day be the final pope, okay? And that he will come and he will reign over the entire world from the Vatican, basically. And so it is world conquest. And what they're doing, what Christ teaches, and what the Bible teaches, is that Christ does all of the work, and he's the one that sets up his kingdom. But with most of the ones who teach replacement theology, Roman Catholic Church included, they teach that they have to prepare the kingdom for Christ. Okay?
Yeah.
And so in doing that, the Catholic Church is seeking to, that's one reason for the Crusades and the conquests and everything, to dominate and conquer the entire world. They were preparing the kingdom so that the world would be completely conquered, dominated for Christ to reign. Okay?
Yeah, but it's the work done, in other words.
Yeah, that's what they were trying to do. They're like, okay, we're going to do all the work. We're going to do God a favor. And we're going to set up a kingdom on this earth. And then Christ, all he has to do is just come sit on the throne. But in all the prophecies and all the things that are showed in the scriptures, it's not that the world gets better and better and better and gets to the place where Christ is ready to come and take on a perfect world. That Christ comes down, does the hard work, and prepares it for himself.
Yeah.
Okay? And rather than coming down and being the final pope ruling from Rome, he's going to one day come and sit on the throne of David in Jerusalem.
Right.
Okay? And now there's a lot of things that happen in between that, and I mean, we can go in several rabbit trails chasing that through.
Yeah.
But that's why there's a hatred for the Jews, is because they see them as Christ rejectors. Now, the funny thing that I've always seen, especially within the Catholic Church, is that they look at the Jews as being the ones who crucified Christ. But under whose authority did they crucify Christ? Rome's.
Right.
It was Roman soldiers that nailed him to the cross. It was Pontius Pilate, a Roman, that gave the order for crucifixion. I mean, they were both complicit in the thing. But then the Romans hate the Jews and accuse them of killing God.
And we ought to hand in it.
Yeah, they had a hand in it as well.
Yeah.
And so it's crazy, but that's why there is the hatred of the Jews in the world today. And then on top of that, not just the replacement theology, but just the fact that they have been God's people and that they have named the true and living God, that they bring the ire of other groups as well. You've got the Muslims hate the Jews, okay? And the reason for that is the Muslims claim that they are God's chosen people and they are descendants of Ishmael, okay?
But God had no favorites. We're all his people.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, what gives them this idea, crazy idea, to think that we say the Catholics are better than the Protestants. You know, it's mad.
It is.
And
that's where it comes down to, and this is what we've taught a lot, is that it comes down to the matter of authority, that the Bible is our authority, and we come back to, you know, what God has said, because we have to have an authority we can depend upon, and we believe the Bible to be exactly what God would have us to know about him. Okay,
yeah.
God used human instruments to pen his word, and we have a very special spiritual book here. I mean, this isn't like any other book. It wasn't just men got together and thought, okay, well, we're going to write this out. But the Bible is the word of God.
Yeah.
And so we put everything through the filter, if you would, of the word of God to figure out, you know, what's true and what's not. But you get into all these other religions and groups, and they're adding so many other things to it, or they're looking at other authorities and they're going so completely contrary to the scripture. And I do want to say that with what we teach and things and what we're looking at from scripture, it's not a matter of we're better than anyone else either.
No.
And I mean, I hope you've seen that from being here.
Yes, it's very straightforward.
Yeah. It's not that anyone's favorites or anyone's better than others.
Yes.
It's that the truth is knowable. I mean, honestly, the truth is knowable.
Yes.
And it's not that we're better, but it's that we're sticking with the truth.
Yeah.
Right.
And
don't draw these here.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I mean, I don't for a second feel superior to anybody else, but I will say what we believe is superior in the fact that it is the truth.
The truth. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's not a thing of pride or arrogance or said braggingly, but it does come down to a place where truth is the final authority.
Right.
And
he said the truth and set us free.
And so with all of that, it comes down to what Christ said, that he is the only way. He says, mm-hmm. I am the way, the truth, and the life.
Mm-hmm.
No man cometh to the Father but by me. He's the only way, and he's laid out his way in scriptures. I mean, he showed us the way. And so any of these other groups, they are, you know, they got all these other teachings and stuff, just like being anti-Israel. I mean, it's clearly laid out in scripture that that's not the truth.
Yeah.
I mean, even what we looked at in the book of Romans in chapters 9, 10, and 11, that he wasn't done with Israel yet. He still got a plan.
Yeah.
And that was being written to primarily Gentiles at the time,
mm-hmm.
saying that God still had a program for Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And so Christians of all people should be the most pro-Israel of anybody.
Exactly right.
They should be. I mean, even the Apostle Paul, of course, he was a Jew, but even the Apostle Paul, as he was being persecuted by Israel and they were trying to kill him, and, you know, he saw whenever they crucified Christ and they, you know, he knew all these things that they had done. He still said that his heart's desire was for Israel, that they'd be saved.
Right.
And that he was willing to lay down his own life, that he was willing that he himself would be accursed if it meant Israel would be saved. But of course, that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
But he said he was willing that much. And so he had a love even for the nation of Israel at that time. He wasn't, hey, you all messed up. You gave up your chance. Sorry about your luck. And so there isn't this great divide, this I'm better than you in any of it. Never was. The Jews took it to be that way. And the funny thing that I see, okay, I see a big parallel here. Okay? I see a huge parallel here. And I don't mean this in an offensive way whatsoever, but the Jewish religious system of Jesus' day is almost perfectly a mirror image of the current religious system that we have in Ireland.
And yes, it is. It really is.
It is. I mean, if you start studying the New Testament, start looking through what the Jews did in the New Testament, in Jesus' time, how the synagogue, or not the synagogue, how the temple was set up, how the sacrifices was done and things, and the way the religious system did, and the way that the I guess, to make the parallel here, the way that the church operated at that time, the Jewish
yes.
group there operated at that time, I mean, it is almost identical to the way that the Roman Catholic Church operates.
Yes.
Almost identical. And to the place where in first century Israel, the center hub of all religion, of the Jewish religion, was the temple in Israel, in Jerusalem. They had a city, they had a hub, they had a spot in the middle, okay? It would be the equivalent of the Vatican today.
Yeah.
They had a high priest that ruled over all of it.
Yeah.
They had their own religious councils and groups that ruled over all of the synagogues in all of the far-reaching areas,
mm-hmm.
everywhere they went.
Mm-hmm.
They had many requirements upon the people. The lay people, so to speak, had no power, no authority, nothing whatsoever. They just had to do what they were told. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way that that operated. They went through hollow rituals and ceremonies. The temple became a place of commerce. It was a money-making racket. That's what the temple was. Why did Jesus come over or come in the temple and overthrow the money changers' tables and all those things? Well, what was going on at that time, to fulfill this parallel here, what was going on at that time was that there were certain sacrifices that God had instituted in the law, okay, for sin and different things and for the Passover. And so they were supposed to be without spot, without blemish, and these kind of things. So people would go to their herd, they would bring an animal, they would offer up the sacrifice so that they were showing that their sin cost them, cost them death. And it was showing a picture of Christ, the Lamb that would one day take away the sins of the world. God had a picture, an illustration to prepare them for his program that he had, basically. And so in the Jewish temple worship, they took that and they made a business of it. Okay? And so people would bring their sacrifices to the temple. And whenever they brought their sacrifice to the temple, there would be priests and different ones there. And they would look at the sacrifice and say, no, your lamb's not good enough. Your sacrifice isn't good enough. Yeah. And so there's blemishes. There's something wrong with your sacrifice. And so yours won't do. But I'll tell you what. We've got some out back over here. And I'll sell you one.
Oh, my God.
At much higher price than what you could ever get out of your lamb.
Right.
You know, these are special temple lambs. And so you have to buy one here in order to make your sacrifice at the temple, because yours isn't good enough. You have to use ours.
Rather than the poor people.
And here's another thing that they did. Remember, there was money changers, and you know, we're familiar with difference in currencies and stuff like that. They instituted their very own temple currency. Okay? And so it was only good for the temple. And so wherever you came from, if you came from Samaria, if you came from Judea, if you came from Syria, if wherever you came from to worship in the temple, you had to exchange your money for the temple currency to pay your offerings and tithes. And then they would do just like money changers do, and they would have out of whack exchange rates. And you would be losing money on the exchanges. You would be losing money on buying the animal. You would be having to go through all of these processes, and it turned it into what Jesus said, a house of merchandise, you know. So it was crazy. This is what they had done. They took what was pure and holy and what was meant to be a picture of God's provision of a substitute for mankind. You know, the sacrifice is a picture of Jesus Christ dying as a substitute for mankind. And they took all that and they made a farce out of it. They made a money-making scheme. And they were making a fortune out of it. And they had the people over a barrel because they said, okay, you have to do your religious duties. And you have to pay the amounts. You have to do all of these things because your eternity and your relationship with God is at stake. And so basically what they turned the religion into was religious blackmail.
Oh my God. They manipulated them so much.
Yeah. And it's the same thing that you see today.
Yeah.
And they turned it into religious blackmail. Oh, you want us to do your funeral? Well, it's going to cost you this. You know, you want us to come and visit you here? Well, it's going to cost you. If you give more money to the church, then we'll be doing more for you. If you're poor, I'm sorry about your luck, but we don't care about you.
Oh, my gosh.
And so they do all these things, you know.
Religion is evil.
And it is.
It is.
It is.
Yeah.
And that's why Jesus wasn't much for religion. You look at him with a religious crowd. You know, there's Christians today, or so-called Christians, that will use some of Jesus's words and actions to justify their ugly actions. Okay? Just like him coming into the temple and throwing over the tables. Okay? Mm-hmm. And him calling, you know, generation of vipers and whited sepulchers and some of the... I mean, he says some harsh things. But you know who he always says the harsh things and does the harsh things to? The religious guys.
Yeah.
That's who he always does that to. But whenever he runs into someone who is a poor, broken sinner, you know how he treats them.
Yeah.
You see the woman at the well.
Yeah.
He deals with her tenderly.
Yeah.
Zacchaeus deals with him tenderly. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was a crook. Yeah. The rich young ruler come to him at night.
What?
Dealt with him tenderly.
That we're gone so, such hypocrites.
Sin.
Sin.
Sin in the flesh.
Oh, love of mine.
And here's the biggest thing is that we have got away from worshiping God, and we worship ourselves, and we worship man in the name of God.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's what ended up happening. And so we've lost our love for God, and we've lost our fear of God in many times. And that's what it ends up being. And so what we learn about in the Bible, and what we're seeing as we're studying this out, that's why the Bible is so important. I mean, the Bible reveals to us God, His nature, His plan, who He is. I mean, that's why the Bible is the most important book we could ever read, is that as we're reading through the Bible, as we're reading through the Bible, it is showing us who God is.
Right.
And we find out very quickly as we study the Scriptures that God doesn't line up with these religions that's out here. I mean, the God that they are portraying is not the God of the Bible. The religion that they have, their system of religion, is not what God gave throughout the Bible. It's definitely not New Testament Christianity.
Right.
And so this is what, just kind of coming full circle here for a moment, and we'll wrap up. But this is what Paul was coming against Peter for. Because you can see even in the time while Paul was still alive, Peter was still alive. I mean, this was the generation that Christ died in. Almost immediately, corruption started setting in.
Right.
The Judaizers coming in and adding to Christianity a bunch of religious rules and rituals. And saying, yes, you're saved by grace through faith, but now you've got to do this, you've got to do that, you've got to give this, you've got to, you know, mass and penance and all. I mean, adding to Christ, things that never were there,
right,
and putting that on top of it. And that's what the Judaizers were doing back then. It was different things. It wasn't mass and penance. It was circumcision and Sabbath days and feasts and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
But it was extra biblical mandates upon mankind to try to earn God's favor. That's what it was. That's what it amounted to. And so that's what the Judaizers were doing to the Galatians. And that's what Peter's actions was starting to do. I mean, it was very subtle. That's the amazing thing. It's very subtle what Peter was doing, but he was giving in to the pressure of man, fearing man more than God. That pleasing man got more important to him than pleasing God. And so he was lifting up religion and the religious system and the Jews and putting down the Gentiles. And so that's where Paul steps in here, and he shows clearly that it's not by the law, not by their actions, not by their works that they were saved. And he's making that clear to Peter. And that's where we were looking at here in verses 15 through 18. We were still in verse number 15, but I'll leave the rest of this for next week, I believe. But we were in verse 15 where he says that we who are Jews by nature and not sinners of the Gentile. He said this is your attitude that you're getting down to. It's us versus them. And just to clarify this, so we're not going this whole week with the wrong perspective of what he's saying in verse number 15. He's not saying we are better than them.
No.
That we are Jews and they are sinners. He's saying that was their perspective. That was the message that Peter was portraying there.
Right.
However, that wasn't the truth. That wasn't what was going on. Because in verse number 16, he says clearly that for by the works of the law shall no flesh be justified. There at the end of verse 16. In verse number 17, he says clearly that even we as Jews have to admit that we are sinners,
right,
in order to be justified. We have to come to the realization that it's not our goodness, it's not our heritage, it's nothing that we do that has caused us to be justified, or in other words, completely forgiven, our entire debt erased. That word justified, it means just as if I'd never sinned.
Right.
Clean slate.
Yeah.
And he said, it wasn't any of our works that caused us to have a clean slate.
Right.
It was we had to realize our slate was dirty and let him wipe it clean.
Exactly right.
Just the same as the Gentiles.
Right.
And that brings it back to equality there in verse number 17. But while we seek to be justified by Christ, if we as Jews... because he's talking about me and Peter, right? Paul and Peter. If we are seeking to be justified, our slate wiped clean through Christ, it says we ourselves also are found sinners. And so he says we're just like them. Exactly. We are sinners just like the Gentiles. And he says, is therefore Christ the minister of sin? God forbid. What he's saying there is if we were doing okay as Jews, if we were so wonderful, and if we had God's favor just because we were Jews and we kept the law, then Christ came and then we have to recognize that we're sinners in order to be justified and saved. Did Christ make us sinners? If we were so good before and now we're sinners, did Christ make us sinners? And he says, God forbid. In other words, we were sinners all along and we were never any better than they were.
Right.
And so in verse number 16 there, that we kind of skipped over a little bit, that man is not justified by the works of the law, or by any works for that matter.
All right.
He's not justified. He's not made just, made whole. Like I said, that clean slate. Mm-hmm. And whenever I say a clean slate, we often, that might not be a good saying, because we have this idea that, you know, we trust Christ, we have a clean slate, and then we've got to try to keep it clean. Mm-hmm. No, that's not what we're talking about. I mean, our record has been completely, I mean, the all of the charges have been thrown out, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Could you imagine here going to the courts and being completely guilty? Completely guilty. But in amongst all of that, you know, we've got a sentence to pay. We need restitution. We need all of these things to pay. And Christ comes down and he says, I will serve their sentence and I will pay their restitution.
Right.
Put all of that on me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so, and I know this isn't necessarily how human courts work. This is how spiritual, this is how courts working for God. Okay? And so, you know, I'm completely guilty. I did the crimes. I did everything.